speaking to? I stop laughing and press the red button because she is making me tear up. My feet sink into the snow as I hurry through town. I'm pretty sure that at some point I'm going to take a step and my foot won't stop. It'll just keep sinking down through the snow until I've disappeared entirely. If it wasn't for the street lights, it would be pitch black. But the lights are painting the white with a dull yellowish glow. The snow looks sick, diseased. 15 minutes later, I push my way through a hedge to get into school because the main gates are locked. I get a big old scratch on my face, and upon inspection using my phone screen, I decide I quite like it. The car park is deserted. I trudge through the snow toward the main entrance, and as I draw closer, I see that the door is ajar. I head inside, immediately noticing the white burglar and fire alarm box on the wall, or what used to be a white box on the wall. It's been torn away and is hanging from the plaster by only a couple of wires. The rest of the wires have all been cut. I stare at it for a few seconds before moving on down a corridor. They're here. I drift for a while, a ghost of Christmas past. I'm reminded of the last time I was here at a stupid hour of the day, weeks ago, with the prefects and Zelda and the violin video. That seems like a long time ago. Everything seems colder now. As I draw closer toward the end of the corridor, I begin to hear unintelligible whispers coming from the corner English classroom. Mr. Kent's classroom. I flatten myself like a spy against the wall by the door. There's a light glaring from its plastic window. Carefully and slowly, I peer into the room. I expect to find a horde of solitaire minions, but what I see instead are three figures huddled by a cluster of tables in the middle of the room, illuminated by an oversized torch shining upward from the table. The first is the guy with the large quiff, who I've seen Lucas with 100 times, in a very Lucas-ish hipster get-up, skinnies, boat shoes, bomber jacket, and Ben Sherman polo. The second person is Evelyn Foley. Quiff has his arm around her. Oh, Evelyn's secret boyfriend is Quiff. I think back to the clay. Had the solitaire voice been a girl's? It's too cold for me to remember anything, so I focus my attention on the third figure, Lucas. Quiff and Evelyn seem to be kind of ganging up on him. Lucas is whispering hurriedly at Quiff. He told me he wasn't a part of solitaire anymore, didn't he? Maybe I should jump into the room and start shouting, waving my phone, threatening to call the police. Maybe. Oh, my God! At the other end of the corridor, Becky Allen blinks into existence and I almost collapse. She points at me with an accusatory finger and hisses, "I knew you wouldn't go home." My eyes, wild and unfocused, spin crazily as she storms down the corridor. Soon, Becky is beside me, in Superman pajama bottoms, tucked into at least 3 pairs of socks and furry boots, along with a hoodie and a coat and all other kinds of woolly clothing. She's here. Becky came here. For me. She looks very strange with no makeup on and her purplish hair all scraped into a greasy sort of bulb. And I don't know why or how this happens, but I am actually relieved that she's here. "Oh my God, you're insane," she whispers. "You are psychotic." And then she hugs me, and I let her. And for several seconds, I really feel like we're friends. She lets go, withdraws, and cringes. "Dude, what have you done to your face?" She lifts her sleeve and wipes it roughly against my cheek, and when she draws it away, it's stained red. Then she smiles and shakes her head. I am reminded of the Becky I knew 3 years ago, before boys, before sex, before alcohol, before she started to move on, while I stayed exactly where I was. I point toward the door to the English room. Look inside. She tiptoes past me and looks, and her face opens up in horror. Evelyn, what the... And why is Lucas? Her mouth hangs wide open as a sudden realization arrives. Is this solitaire? She turns back to me and shakes her head. This is too much mindfuckery for this time of day. I'm not even sure I'm actually awake. Shh. I'm trying to listen to what they're saying. Becky dives past the door and we stand, hidden in the dark on either side of it. And by both carefully peering round the frame, we spy on the gathering. Vaguely, we begin to decipher a conversation. It is 6:04 a.m. Grow some balls, Lucas! Evelyn. She's wearing high-waisted denim shorts and tights and one of those jackets with tartan lining. I'm not even joking. We're terribly sorry to tear you away from your teddy bear and your electric blanket, but can't you just grow some balls? Lucas's face, dotted with shadows, grimaces. Can I please remind you that I am the one who started solitaire in the first place? Therefore, my balls are in no position to be questioned, thanks. Yeah, you started it, says Quiff. It's the first time I get a proper look at him, and for someone with such a large head of hair, he really is tiny. By his side on the table is a Morrison's shopping bag. His voice is also far more sophisticated than I'd anticipated. And you left just when we started to do stuff that's actually worthwhile. We're doing something great. And yet here you are, saying that everything you have worked for has been, and I quote, total and utter bullshit. This isn't what I worked for, Lucas snaps. I thought that messing with this school would help people. Fucking up this school, says Quiff, is the best thing that's ever happened to this town. But this isn't going to help anyone. It's not going to change anything. Changing an environment doesn't change a person. Cut the crap, Lucas. Evelyn shakes her head. You're not Gandhi, babe. You must be able to see what an idiotic idea this is, says Lucas. Just give me the lighter, says Quiff. Becky, her palms flattened against the wall like Spider-Man, whips her head around. Lighter? She mouths. I shrug back. I stare harder at Lucas and realize that behind his back he's holding what at first looks like a gun, but is actually just one of those novelty lighters. There's only one thing you can do with a lighter. No, says Lucas. But even this far away, I can tell that he's nervous. Quiff lunges for Lucas's arm, but he steps backward just in time. Quiff begins to laugh like some evil mastermind. Well, shit, says Quiff. You went through all this trouble, and now you're just going to steal our stuff and run off with it? Like a little kid? Why did you even come here? Why didn't you just go and tell on us like the baby you are? Lucas shifts onto his other leg, silent. Give me the lighter, says Quiff. Last chance. Fuck you, says Lucas. Quiff puts his hand to his face and rubs his forehead, sighing. Christ. Then, like someone flicked a switch in his brain, he swings his fist at lightning speed and punches Lucas in the face. Lucas, with surprising dignity, doesn't fall down. He lifts himself up to his full height and meets Quiff dead in the eye. Fuck you, says Lucas again. Quiff smashes Lucas in the stomach, this time doubling him over. He grabs Lucas's arm with ease and wrenches away the lighter gun, then grabs Lucas by the collar, holds the barrel against his neck, and pushes him against the wall. I expect he thinks he looks like some kind of mafia boss, but it doesn't help him that he's got the face of a 7-year-old and the voice of David Cameron. You couldn't just leave it, could you, mate? You couldn't just leave it alone, could you? It's obvious that Quiff is not going to pull the trigger and burn Lucas's neck. It is obvious to Quiff that Quiff is not going to burn Lucas. It is obvious to all the people who have ever lived and all the people who will ever live that Quiff does not have the strength, will, or malice to seriously wound a fairly innocent guy like Lucas Ryan. But I guess if someone is holding a lighter gun up to your throat, then things like that aren't quite as obvious as they should be. Becky is no longer at my side. She karate kicks the door open. Okay, chaps, just stop. Right now. Stop the madness. With one hand in the air, she strides out from our hiding place. Evelyn makes some kind of squealing sound. Lucas lets out a triumphant laugh, and Quiff drops Lucas's collar and steps backward, as if afraid that Becky might arrest him right there on the spot. I follow her in and immediately regret it. Lucas sees me and stops laughing. Becky stomps up and places herself directly between Lucas and the lighter gun. Her makeupless face transforms her into a thin-eyed, pale-faced warrior. Oh, darling, she sighs at Quiff and tilts her head, faux sympathetically. You actually think you're intimidating, don't you? I mean, where in God's name did you get that piece of crap? Costcutter? Quiff tries to laugh it off but fails. Becky's eyes turn to fire. She holds out her hands. Go for it, dude. Her eyebrows are all the way up her forehead. Go on. Set fire to my hair or whatever. I am relatively intrigued to see if you can pull that trigger. I can see Quiff desperately trying to think of something witty to say. After a few awkward moments, he stumbles backward, grabs a Morrison's bag, puts the lighter into it, and pulls the trigger. The lighter flame glows orange for approximately 2 seconds before Quiff pulls it away and casts the bag dramatically toward the classroom's bookshelf. Whatever is inside the bag begins to smoke and rustle. Everyone in the room looks at the bag. The smoke gradually thins. The plastic bag withers a little before flopping off the shelf and onto the floor upside down. There is a long silence. Eventually, Becky throws her head back and roars with laughter. Oh my God! Oh my God! Quiff has nothing to say anymore. There's no way he can take back what just happened. I think this is just about the stupidest thing I have ever seen. This is Solitaire's grand finale? Becky continues to laugh. Oh my God, you really are the most deluded of all the hipsters I've met. You bring a whole new meaning to the word deluded. Quiff lifts the lighter and sways a little toward the bag, as if he's going to try again. But Becky grabs him violently by the wrist and with her other hand wrenches the gun away. She waves it in the air and withdraws her phone from her coat pocket. Take one step toward that plastic bag, bitch, and I'm calling the popo. She raises her eyebrows like a disappointed teacher. Don't think I don't know your name, Erin Riley. Quiff, or Erin Riley, or whoever, squares up to her. You think they'd believe some slag? Becky throws her head back for the second time. Oh, man, I've met so many Bellends like you. She pats Quiff on the arm. You do the whole tough guy thing really well, mate. Well done. I steal a quick glance at Lucas, but he's just staring at Becky, absently shaking his head. You're all the same, says Becky. All you idiots who think that by playing the self-righteous intellect, you rule the entire world. Why don't you go home and complain about it on your blog like normal people. She takes a step toward him. I mean, what are you trying to do here, dude? What's Solitaire trying to do? Do you all think that you're better than everyone else? Are you trying to say that school isn't important? Are you trying to teach us about morals and how to be a better person? Are you trying to say that if we just laugh about it all, if we just stir up some shit and put smiles on our faces, then life's going to be hunky-dory? Is that what Solitaire's trying to do? She lets out a monstrous cry of exasperation, actually making me jump. Sadness is a natural human emotion, you giant dick! Evelyn, who has been watching with her lips pursed the entire time, finally speaks up. Why are you judging us? You don't even understand what we're doing. Oh, Evelyn, really? Solitaire? You're with Solitaire? Becky begins to flick the lighter on and off. Perhaps she's as deranged as I am. Evelyn cowers backward. And this prick has been your special secret boyfriend all along. He's wearing more hair product than I've used in the past year, Evelyn. She shakes her head like a weary old person. Solitaire. Bloody hell, I feel like I'm in year 8 all over again. Why are you acting like such a special snowflake? Says Evelyn. You think you're a better person than us? Becky screeches with laughter and tucks a lighter gun into her pajama trousers. A better person? Ah, I've done some shitty things to people, and now I'm admitting it. You know what, Evelyn? Maybe I want to be a special snowflake. Maybe sometimes I just want to express the emotions that I'm actually feeling instead of having to put on this happy, smiley facade that I put on every day just to come across to bitches like you as not boring. She points at me again as if she's punching the air. Apparently, Tori understands what you guys are trying to do. I have no idea why you're trying to destroy our crappy little school. But Tori thinks that, you know, on the whole, you're doing something bad, and I fucking believe her. Her arm drops. Dear God, Evelyn, you severely piss me off. Jesus Christ. Creepers are the ugliest shoes I have ever seen. Go back to your blog or Glastonbury or wherever you came from and stay there. Quiff and Evelyn take one last horrified glare at Becky before giving up. It's kind of remarkable in a way. Because people are very stubborn and they don't like to be proven wrong. I think that they both knew that what they were about to do was wrong, though, or they didn't have the guts to go through with it deep down. Maybe, when it came down to it, they'd never been the real antagonists. But if they're not, then who is? We follow the pair slowly out of the room and down the corridor. We watch as they wander away out through the double doors. If I were them, I would probably change schools immediately. They will be gone in a minute. Gone forever. They will be gone. We stay there for a while, not saying anything. After a few minutes, I begin to sweat. Maybe I feel angry. No, I don't feel anything. Lucas is standing next to me, and he turns. His eyes are big and blue and dog-like. Why did you come here, Victoria? Those two would have hurt you, I point out. But we both know this isn't true. Why did you come? Everything's so blurry. Lucas sighs. Well, it's finally over. Becky kind of saved us all. Becky seems to be having a kind of stunned breakdown, slumped on the floor against the wall, with her Superman logoed legs sprawled out in front of her. She holds a lighter gun up to her face, flicking it on and off in front of her eyes. and I can just about hear her muttering, "This is the most pretentious novelty lighter I've ever seen. This is so pretentious." "Am I forgiven?" asks Lucas. "Maybe I'm going to pass out." I shrug. "You're not actually in love with me, are you?" He blinks, and he's not looking at me. No. It wasn't love, really. It was... I just thought I needed you. For some reason." He shakes his head. "I actually think that Becky's rather lovely." I try not to throw up or stab myself with my house keys. I stretch my face into a grin like a toy clown. "Ha ha ha, you and the rest of the solar system." Lucas's expression changes, like he finally gets who I am. "Could you not call me Victoria anymore?" I ask. He steps away from me. "Yeah, sure. Tory." I start to feel hot. Were they going to do what I think they were going to do? Lucas's eyes keep moving around, not looking at me. "They were going to burn the school down," he says. It seems almost funny. Another childhood dream. If we were 10, perhaps we'd rejoice in the idea of the school on fire. Because that would mean no more school, wouldn't it? But it just seems violent and pointless now. As violent and pointless as all the other things that Solitaire has done. And then I realize something. I turn around. "Where are you going?" asks Lucas. I walk down the corridor back to Kent's classroom, getting hotter and hotter the closer I get. "What are you doing?" I gaze into the classroom, and I wonder if I've lost it entirely. "Tori?" I turn to Lucas and look at him standing at the other end of the corridor. Really, properly look at him. "Get out," I say, maybe too quietly. "What?" "Take Becky and get out." "Wait, what are you?" And then he sees the orange glow lighting up one side of my body. The orange glow coming from the fire that is raging through Kent's classroom. "Holy shit," says Lucas. And then I'm racing down the corridor toward the nearest fire extinguisher, tugging at it, but it won't come off the wall. There's a horrific crack. The door to the classroom has split and is burning happily. Lucas has joined me at the extinguisher, but however hard we tug, we can't get it off the wall. The fire creeps out of the room and spreads to the wall displays, the ceiling filling steadily with smoke. "We need to get out," Lucas shouts over the roaring flames. "We can't do anything." "Yes, we can." "We have to. We have to do something. I have to do something." I abandon the extinguisher and head farther into the school. There'll be another one in the next corridor, in the science corridor. Becky has leapt up from the floor. She goes to run after me, as does Lucas, but a giant wall display suddenly flops off the wall in a fiery wreck of paper and pins, blocking the corridor. I can't see them. The carpet catches light, and the flames begin to advance toward me. "Tori!" someone screams. I don't know who. I don't care. I locate the fire extinguisher, and this one easily detaches from the wall. It says water on it, but also do not use on burning liquid fires or live electrical equipment. The fire edges down the corridor, on the walls, the ceiling, the floor, pushing me backward. There are lights, plug sockets everywhere. "Tori!" This time the voice comes from behind me. Two hands place themselves on my shoulders, and I leap around as if it's death itself. But it's not. It's him, in his t-shirt and jeans, glasses, hair, arms, legs, eyes, everything. It's Michael Holden. He wrenches the extinguisher from my arms, and he hurls it out of the nearest window. Chapter 15. I am forced down the corridor and thrown out of the nearest fire exit. How Michael knew we were here, I don't know. What's he doing? I don't know. But I need to stop that fire. I need to be in there. If I can't do anything, then it will have been for nothing. My whole life, everything, nothing. He tries to grab me, but I'm practically a torpedo. I race back through the fire exit and down the next corridor, away from the oncoming flames, searching for another fire extinguisher. I'm sort of hyperventilating and I can't see anything, and I'm running so fast that I have no idea where this corridor is in the school, and I start tearing up again. But Michael can run like he skates. He grabs me around the waist just as I tug the fire extinguisher off the wall, just as the fire bypasses the fire exit and closes us in. Tori, we need to get out now. The fire draws Michael's face out of the dark. I flail around in his grip and burst forward, but he closes his fist around my forearm and squeezes it and starts to drag me. And before I know what I'm doing, I'm yanking my arm so hard that my skin starts to burn. I'm screaming at him and pushing, and I swing my leg around and actually kick him in the stomach. I must kick him hard, because he tumbles backward and clutches his body. I instantly realize what I've done and freeze, looking at him in the orange light. We meet each other's eyes, and he seems to realize something. And I want to laugh because, yeah, he's finally realized, just like Lucas did eventually. And I hold my arms out to him. And then I see the fire. The inferno in the science lab to our right. The science lab that's connected to that English classroom by one single doorway, which the flames must have stormed straight through. I leap forward into Michael and push him away. And the classroom explodes outward. Crumpled tables, chairs, flying fireballs of books. I'm on the ground several meters away, miraculously alive. And I open my eyes but can see nothing. Michael is lost somewhere around me in the smoke. I scramble backward as a chair leg soars past my cheek and scream his name. No way of knowing if he's alive or... I get up and run. Crying? Shouting things. A name? His name? Solitaire's eternal idea. That childhood dream. Is he dead? No. I see a shape rise vaguely from the smoke, flailing around before disappearing farther into the school. At one point, I think I hear him calling me, but I might just be imagining it. I scream his name and I'm running again out of the smoke cloud, away from the science corridor. Around the corner, flames have reached an art classroom, and the artwork, hours and hours of it, is melting into globules of fried acrylic and dripping onto the floor. It's so sad that I want to cry. But the smoke has already started that. I start to panic, too. Not because of the fire. Not even because I'm losing and Solitaire is winning. Because Michael is in here. Another corridor. Another. Where am I? Nothing is the same in the dark and the burning. Epileptic lights flash around me like sirens, like I'm passing out. Diamonds sparkling. I'm screaming again. Michael Holden. The fire growls and a hurricane of hot air careers through the school's tunnels. I call out for him. I'm calling him over and over again. I'm shaking so hard. The artwork and the handwritten essays on the walls are disintegrating around me, and I cannot breathe. I failed. I say these words right as I'm thinking them. It's funny. This never happens. I failed. I failed. It's not the school I failed. It's not even myself. It's Michael. I failed him. I failed to stop being sad. He tried so hard. He tried so hard to be nice, to be my friend, and I failed him. I stopped screaming. There is nothing now. Michael, dead. The school, dying. And me. There is nothing now. And then, a voice. My name in the smoke. I spin on the spot, but there are only flames that way. What building am I in? There must be a window, a fire exit, something, but everything is burning. The smoke slowly starting to suffocate the air, and eventually me. So before I know what I'm doing, I'm tearing up a flight of stairs onto the second floor, smoke and flames at my heels. I turn left, left again, right, into a classroom. The door slams behind me. I grab a chair, not thinking about anything except fire and smoke and dying, and smash the thin window. I close my eyes as a sprinkling of glass dust showers over my hair. I climb out into the morning and onto the top of what seems to be a concrete roof, and finally, finally, I remember where I am. The beautiful place. The small concrete roof of the art conservatory. The field of snow and the river. The black morning sky. Cold air. Infinite space. A thousand thoughts at once. Michael Holden is 900 of them. The rest are self-hatred. I failed to do anything. I look at the smashed window. What does that lead to? Only pain. I look at the metal stairs to my right. What do they lead to? Only myself failing time and time again to do anything right or say anything right. I'm at the edge and I look down. It's far. It's calling me. A hope of something better. A third option. It's so hot. I take my coat and gloves off. It hits me then. I haven't ever known what I wanted out of life. Until now. I sort of want to be dead. Chapter 16. My feet drift absently closer to the edge. I think about Michael Holden, mainly about how he's secretly angry all the time. I think that a lot of people are secretly angry all the time. I think about Lucas Ryan, and that makes me feel sadder. There is another tragedy in which I am not the rescuer. I think about my ex-best friend, Becky Allen. I don't think I know who she is. I think I knew before we grew up. But after that, she changed, and I didn't. I hope that I can understand why one day. I think about my brother, Charlie Spring, and Nick Nelson. Sometimes paradise isn't what people think it should be. I think about Ben Hope. Sometimes people hate themselves. And while I think, Harvey Green Grammar School dissolves. My feet peep slightly over the concrete roof. If I fall accidentally, the universe will be there to catch me. And then? Then there he is. Charlie Spring. A lone dot in orange-tinted white. He's waving and screaming up. Don't! Don't, he says. And there's another figure running along. Taller, stouter. He clutches Charlie's hand. Nick Nelson. Then another, and another. Why? What's wrong with people? Why do they never give you any peace? There's Lucas and Becky. Becky puts her hands on her mouth. Lucas puts his hands on his head. Charlie's screaming in battle with the wind and flames. Screaming, whirling, burning. Stop! This voice is closer and comes from above. I decide that it is probably God, because I think that this is probably how God works. He waits until your final moments, and then he'll step in and take you seriously. It's like when you're 4 years old and you tell your parents that you're going to run away, and they say, okay, go right ahead, like they don't care. And they only start caring when you actually walk out the door and down the road with your teddy bear under your arm and a packet of biscuits in your rucksack. Tori. I turn around and look up. At the top of the school building, above the window that I smashed, is Michael Holden, lying on his front over the roof, so that only his head and shoulders are visible from below. He holds out an arm to me. Please. The mere sight of him makes me want to die even more. The school's burning down, I say, turning back the other way. You need to leave. Turn around, Tori. Turn around, you absolute twat. Something wrenches me around. I take out my torch, wondering briefly why I haven't used it until now, and I shine it upward. I see him then, properly, hair all messed up and dusty, patches of soot smothering his face, a burn mark on his outstretched arm. Do you want to kill yourself? He asks. And the question sounds unreal, because you never hear anyone ever asking that question in real life. I don't want you to do that, he says. I can't let you do that. You can't leave me here alone. His voice breaks. You need to be here, he says. And then he does that thing that I do. His mouth sort of sucks itself in and turns down, and his eyes and nose crinkle up, and one tear creeps out of the corner of his blue eye, and he raises his hands to cover up his face. I'm sorry, I say, because his face, all scrunched up and melting, physically hurts me. I start to cry too. Against my will, I step away from the edge and closer to him, and I hope that this makes him understand. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Shut up. He's smiling while crying, madly, throwing his hands from his face and raising both arms up. Then he punches the ground. God, I'm stupid. I can't believe I didn't realize this any sooner. I can't believe it. I'm pretty much directly under his face. His glasses begin to slide off his nose, and he swiftly pushes them back on. You know, the worst thing is that when I threw away that fire extinguisher you were holding, I wasn't just thinking about saving you, he chuckles sadly. We all need saving, really. Then why? I pause, suddenly understanding everything. This boy, this person. How has it taken me this long to understand? He needed me as much as I needed him, because he was angry, and he has always been angry. You wanted the school to burn. He chuckles again and rubs his eyes. You do know me. And he's right. I do know him. Just because someone smiles doesn't mean that they're happy. I've never been good enough, he says. I get so stressed out. I don't make friends. God, I can't make friends. His eyes glaze over. Sometimes I just wish I were a normal human being. But I can't. I'm not, no matter how hard I try. And then the school was burning, and I thought, something told me it might be a way out of all this. I thought it would make me feel better, and you feel better. He swivels into a sitting position, legs dangling over the edge mere centimeters from my head. I was wrong, he says. I look back out to the edge of the building. No one is happy. What is there in the future? Some people aren't meant for school, says Michael. That doesn't mean they aren't meant for life. I can't, I say. The edge is so close. I can't. Let me help you. Why would you do that? He jumps down to the roof I'm standing on and looks at me. Really looks. I'm reminded of the time I first saw myself in his oversized glasses. The Tory looking back at me now seems different somehow. One person can change everything, he says. And you have changed everything for me. Behind him, a small fireball erupts out of a roof. It temporarily lights the tips of Michael's hair, but he doesn't even blink. You are my best friend, he says. A flush of red passes over him, and it makes me embarrassed to see him embarrassed. He awkwardly flattens his hair with one hand and wipes his eyes. We're all going to die, one day. So I want to get it right first time, you know? I don't want to make any more mistakes, and I know that this is not a mistake. He smiles. You are not a mistake. He turns abruptly and gazes toward the burning school. Maybe we would have been able to stop it, he says. Maybe. Maybe if. If I hadn't. His voice catches in his throat, and he brings a hand up to his mouth, his eyes filling with tears again. This is a new feeling, or a very old one. I do something that I don't expect. I reach out. My arm lifts up and moves forward through the air toward him. I just want to make sure he's there, to make sure I haven't made him up. My hand touches his sleeve. You shouldn't hate yourself, I say, because I know that he doesn't just hate himself for letting the school burn. He hates himself for a whole lot of other reasons, too. But he shouldn't hate himself. He can't. He makes me believe that there are good people in this world. I don't know how this has happened, but what I do know is that this feeling has been there from the very start. When I met Michael Holden, I knew, deep down, that he was the best person you could possibly hope to be. So perfect that he was unreal. And it made me sort of hate him. However, rather than slowly learning more and more good things about him, I have come across flaw after flaw after flaw. And you know what? That's what makes me like him now. That's why he is a real perfect person. Because he is a real person. I tell him all this. Anyway, I say, unsure how to end this, but knowing that I must make my conclusion. I'll never hate you. Maybe I can help you to understand why I will never hate you. A pause. The sound of burning. The smell of smoke. He looks at me like I've shot him. And then we kiss. Neither of us is really sure whether it is an appropriate moment, me having almost accidentally killed myself and all, and Michael hating himself so much. But it happens anyway. Everything finally making sense. Knowing that it would be apocalyptic for me not to be here with him. Because right then, at that moment, it's like, actually, I really would die if I don't hold him. I think I've loved you since I met you, he says, as we draw apart. I just mistook it for curiosity. Not only is that hideously untrue, I say, feeling like I'm about to pass out, but that is also the dumbest rom-com line I've ever had to endure. And I've endured many, what with me being such a fabulous guy magnet. He blinks. A grin creeps across his face, and he laughs, throwing his head back. Oh my God, there you are, Tori, he says, laughing hard, pulling me into another hug and practically lifting me off the ground. Oh my God. Without warning, he retreats back and points outward and says, What in the name of Guy Fawkes is going on? I turn, puzzled, toward the field. The white is mostly gone. There are no longer only 4 dots, but at least 100. Dozens and dozens of teenagers. We hadn't heard them, I guess because of the wind and the fire. But now that they've seen us turn around, they've begun to wave and shout. I cannot see the faces clearly, but each person is a whole person. A whole person with a whole life, who gets out of bed in the morning and goes to school and talks to friends and eats food and lives. They're chanting our names, and I don't know most of them, and most of them don't know me. I don't even know why they're here. But still. Still. In the middle, I can see Charlie being given a piggyback by Nick and Becky by Lucas. They're waving and shouting. I don't, I say, my voice cracking. Understand. Michael retrieves his phone from his pocket and loads up the solitaire blog. There's nothing new there. Then he loads up Facebook and scrolls down the feed. Well, he says, and I look over his shoulder at the phone. Lucas Ryan. Solitaire is burning down Higgs. 32 minutes ago, via mobile, 94 like this, 43 shares. View all 203 comments. Maybe, says Michael. Maybe he thought, the school burning. It was too amazing to let it go to waste. I look at him, and he looks at me. Don't you think it's kind of magnificent? He says. And it is. The school is burning. This doesn't happen in real life. Lucas Ryan. You damn miraculous hipster, says Michael, gazing down at the crowd. You really did something beautiful. Something inside my heart makes me smile. A real smile. And then things go blurry again, and I sort of start to laugh and cry at the same time, and I am unsure whether I am happy or entirely deranged, because I'm sort of curled into myself. Michael has to lean over my head to properly hold me while I'm shaking, but he does it anyway. Snow falls. Behind us, the school crumbles, and I can hear the fire engines making their way through the town. So, he says, slyly raising his eyebrows in true Michael suavity, you hate yourself? I hate myself? Common interests. We should get together. I don't know why, but I start to feel quite delirious. The sight of all those people down there. Some of them are jumping up and down and waving. Some of them are only there because they tagged along for an adventure. But for once, I don't think that any of them are conceited or faking it. They're all just being people. I mean, I'm still not 100% sure that I really want to wake up tomorrow. I'm not fixed just because Michael's here. I still want to get into bed and lie there all day because it's a very easy thing to do. But right now, all I can see are all these kids prancing about in the snow and smiling and waving like they haven't got exams and parents and university choices and career options and all the other stressful things to worry about. There's a guy sitting next to me who noticed it all too. A guy who maybe I can help out, like he helped me out. I can't say that I feel happy. I'm not even sure if I would know if I was. But all those people down there look so funny, and it makes me want to laugh and cry and dance and sing and not take a flying, dramatic, spectacular leap off this building. Really, it's funny because it's true. After. Carl Benson, I haven't seen you since, like, junior year. I thought you killed yourself. Andrew Largeman, what? Carl Benson, I thought you killed yourself. That wasn't you? Andrew Largeman, no, that wasn't me. Garden State, 2004. So I suppose, even after going through all this very carefully with you, I still don't really know how this happened. I'm not traumatized. It's not anything dramatic like that. Nothing has been tearing me apart. I can't focus any of it around one particular day, one particular event, one particular person. All I know is that once it started, it became very easy to let it carry on. And I suppose that's how I ended up here. Michael reckons he's going to get questioned by the police. Probably me too. And Lucas and Becky, I suppose. We were all there. I hope that we don't get arrested. I don't think Lucas would tell what really happened. Then again, I don't really know much about Lucas Ryan anymore. Nick, with surprising practicality, said that the best thing to do was get my parents to meet us at the hospital. So all six of us are now crammed in his car. Me, Michael, Lucas, Becky, Nick, and Charlie. Becky's sitting on Lucas's lap because Nick's car is a tiny Fiat. I think Lucas is genuinely starting to like Becky, I really do. Because she stopped Quiff theoretically shooting him or whatever, he keeps looking up at her with this hilarious expression on his face. And it sort of makes me feel a little bit less sad. She doesn't notice, of course. Becky is a good person in her heart. I guess I've always known that. I'm in the middle seat. I'm finding it very difficult to concentrate on anything as I think I'm half asleep. Snow is falling. All the snowflakes are exactly the same. The song playing on the car stereo is some Radiohead song. Everything outside is dark blue. Charlie calls our parents from the front passenger seat. I do not listen to their conversation. After a while, he hangs up and sits silently for a minute, gazing emptily at his phone. Then he raises his head and stares out into the morning sky. Victoria, he says, and I listen. He says many things. Things that you would expect people to say in this sort of situation, about love and understanding and support and being there. Things that are supposedly not said enough. Things that usually do not need to be said. I don't listen very hard to any of that, because I knew all of it already. Nobody speaks while he speaks. We all just watch the shops drift past the car windows, listening to the hum of the car and the sound of his voice. When he's finished, he turns to face me and says something else. I noticed, he says, but I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. I have begun to cry. I love you anyway, I say, my voice hardly my own. I can't remember if I've ever said those words before in my whole life, not even when I was a child. I start to wonder what I was really like then, and whether I've been imagining myself as someone different this entire time. He smiles a beautiful, sad smile and says, I love you too, Tori. Michael decides to pick up my hand and cup it in his. Do you want to know what Dad said? Says Charlie, turning back to face the front. He's not saying it directly to me, but to the whole car. He said that this is probably because he read The Catcher in the Rye too many times when he was our age, and that it got absorbed into his gene pool. Becky sighs. Jesus! Can't any teenager be sad and, like, not be compared to that book? Lucas smiles at her. I mean, has anyone here even read it? Asks Becky. There is a unanimous chorus of nope. Not even Lucas has read it. Funny that. We listen to the Radiohead song. I have this real urge to leap out of the car. I think Michael can tell that I want to do this. Maybe Lucas too. Charlie keeps glancing into the rearview mirror. After a little while, Nick murmurs, Where are you going to go to sixth form, Charlie? I have never heard Nick speak so quietly. Charlie answers him by holding Nick's hand, which is clutching the gear stick so hard that his knuckles are turning white, and then by saying, Truham, I'll just stay at Truham. I'll be with you, yeah? And I guess lots of us will be going to Truham now. And Nick nods. Becky sleepily leans her head on Lucas's shoulder. I don't want to go to the hospital, I whisper into Michael's ear. This is a half lie. He looks at me, and he's more than pained. I know. He rests his head on the top of mine. I know. Lucas shifts in the seat next to me. He is looking out of the window, at the trees zipping past, the blur of dark and green. This is supposed to be the best time of our lives, he says. Becky snorts into Lucas's shoulder. If this is the best time of my life, I might as well end it immediately. The car revs to get up the slope to the bridge, and then we're sailing over the frozen river. The earth spins a few hundred meters, and the sun creeps a little closer toward our horizon, preparing to spread its dull winter light over what's left of this wasteland. Behind us, a channel of smoke has leaked into the clear sky, blocking out the few remaining stars that had tried to make an impression. Becky continues to mumble, as if speaking through a dream. I get it, though. All they wanted was to make us feel like we belonged to something important, making an impression in the world, because, like, we're all waiting for something to change. Patience can kill you. Her voice lowers to a near whisper. Waiting. Waiting for so long. She yawns. But one day it will end. It always ends. And there's sort of a moment where everyone's sitting and thinking, you know? Like that feeling when you finish watching a film. You turn off the TV, the screen is black, but the pictures are replaying in your head, and you think, what if that's my life? What if that's going to happen to me? Why don't I get that happy ending? Why am I complaining about my problems? I don't know what's going to happen to our school, and I don't know what's going to happen to us. I don't know how long I'm going to be like this. All I know is that I'm here, and I'm alive, and I'm not alone. This is Jane Entwistle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Solitaire by Alice Oseman. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2015 by Alice Oseman. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.